From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's a topic he's tried to avoid but has been forced to confront head on. This morning, Barack Obama came out in full force to talk about race in America and his long-term association with his pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Was he able to mend the broken fences? For more, we have Sherilyn Eiffel. She's a civil rights lawyer and she teaches at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore. Plus Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Welcome.
Thank you, Farai.
Thanks for having me.
So this was a huge day for Barack Obama. I'm going to start with you, Sherilyn. What was your first reaction to the speech?
I have to tell you, Farai, I think it was a huge day for America and for American politics because Barack Obama decided to walk right into the center of what I think many must have advised him to avoid and have advised him to avoid over the last few weeks. And he essentially offered something of a workshop on race in America. And I think he offered it up in all its complexity. It's a big bite out of the sandwich that he offered today, and I hope that people will begin to take it in small parts. It's probably a bigger bite than most of our news media are able to deal with, you know, that cover political campaigns. So I suspect that a good portion of it will get bitten too small and will be distorted. But he really took it from soup to nuts. This wasn't just about his relationship with his pastor, but it was about the very difficult walk or the complex walk that many of us, that all Americans have around this question of race. It's filled with contradictions. It requires our compassion. It requires our acceptance. And he really spoke to all of that in a way that I think was tremendously eloquent and very, very important. Politically, I think it's going to be difficult for people to parse it, but I think it was a tremendous moment for him.
Let's listen to a portion of the speech addressing his relationship with the Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
Did I know him to be an occasionally fierce critic of American domestic and foreign policy? Of course. Did I ever hear him make remarks that could be considered controversial while I sat in the church? Yes. Did I strongly disagree with many of his political views? Absolutely. Just as I'm sure many of you have heard remarks from your pastors, priests, or rabbis with which you strongly disagree.
Ron, is this contradictory in any way to what Senator Obama has been saying this week?
I think it's contradictory to a certain point, Farai. Earlier in the week, or at least late last week, he said that he had been unaware of some of the controversial statements that the minister had made, and he came out this morning and said, well, when I was there, did he make some comments that were controversial? And the answer is yes. I think we'll open the door to many questions, and Senator Obama has certainly not put this issue behind him. But let me take a moment to agree with my colleague. I think Sherilyn's right on so many different levels in her interpretation of this speech. Regardless of your race, regardless of your party affiliation or where you come at this, I think this is going to be a speech that we're going to look at similar to Senator Kennedy when he was running for the presidency and he had to make a major race dealing with his Roman Catholicism. I think historians and Americans are going to look back on this speech and say there was an African-American man at the podium who was addressing important issues of race. And just from the beginning of his speech, Farai, when he talked about we hold these truths to be self-evident, I think that Senator Obama came out and attacked this issue head-on. He was very engaging. There's certainly a lot that critics on the Republican side of the aisle will find fault with. But again, as I said from the start, regardless of where you come from on this issue, I thought it was a remarkable speech and one that's going to be talked about for a good many days to come now.
And Sherilyn, what about the symbolism of him speaking in Philadelphia at the National Constitution Center?
I was just there last weekend at a conference, and it's an amazing building and an amazing exhibit there. And I can only imagine, I wasn't there for his speech, what it was like for him to speak in that place, which is really devoted to looking at the creation of the Constitution, the framers of the Constitution. I think it was perfect because what Barack Obama was trying to say today was he was trying to describe the American condition on race and on faith, I think, also. And he squarely put himself there as an American with all of the complexity that can be involved in being an American. He talked about his own very complicated racial history in his family. He talked about his church. He talked about the black church and what the black church is like. And the part you just did the clip of where he talked about sitting in the pew and hearing your pastor say something you disagree with. I think that rings true for many Americans of faith. I think that rings true for many Catholics who consider themselves good Catholics and who support their parish priests, but don't agree with many of the things their priests say about gays or about women or about not taking birth control. I think it's true for African Americans. If we're going to talk about controversial things, many African Americans in the Black Church sit in the pews while things are said about homosexuals, while things are said about people of different groups and so forth. And I think that he really spoke to that, that it's about engaging and, yes, trying to change from within. But he said he couldn't reject Jeremiah Wright any more than he could reject the Black community or his white grandmother, who he's heard utter racial epithets.
Now, Sherrilyn,
this was amazing.
Let me jump in because we do have a little bit of Senator Obama talking specifically about that section, about his white grandmother.
Yeah. I can no more disown him than I can disown my white grandmother, a woman who helped raise me, a woman who sacrificed again and again for me, a woman who loves me as much as she loves anything in this world, but a woman who once confessed her fear of Black men who passed her by on the street, and who on more than one occasion has uttered racial or ethnic stereotypes that made me cringe.
Ron, is this a situation where some white voters in particular who might have shied away from Barack Obama after the discussion about his pastor will listen to what he's saying in this very specific personal anecdote and walk away with a different perspective?
I do. And I think this speech has a double-edged sword for Senator Obama at this point. He has thus far been able to transcend race. The reason that he is leading the Democrat ticket for the President of the United States is that he is very emotional, he is very eloquent, and he has set out a vision of change that many Americans have grasped onto. He's motivated the young people, and they say this is the sort of voice that we want in Washington, D.C. But this is where the double-edged sword is. The double-edged sword is that many people are looking at Barack Obama as a candidate and as a phenomenon and not looking at him as Barack Obama, Black man running for president. Now he's put the issue of race squarely on the table, which he had to do, and perhaps, and this still remains to be seen, many of those voters who supported him previously who thought he was an element of change, we might now find them delving a little bit deeper into his racial identity, into his racial past, and particularly those two items from the speech that you mentioned, talking about his grandmother and how he could no longer disavow her, or he could not disavow her any more than he could his preacher. People would say, well, wait a second. It's harder to disavow someone due to their bloodlines to you, but you can cut ties with someone due to controversial statements. So again, it will remain to be seen, but unfortunately or fortunately for Barack Obama, race is now injected as a serious element of this presidential campaign.
Sherrilyn, Ron mentions the double-edged sword. What about the double-edged sword of pleasing Black and non-Black voters? Do you get the sense that Black voters want one thing from Barack Obama? Loyalty, identification, shared history, shared culture, and that white voters and non-Black voters in general want something different. Racial openness, willingness to forgive the past, perhaps. I mean, is this just fundamentally a clash of perspectives?
You know, I think Ron is right in the sense that it remains to be seen, but I think if anybody laid down the gauntlet for having the best of both worlds, he did it today, because he said, I could no more disavow Jeremiah Wright than I could the Black community. So that was the embrace. But I think where he switched it up at the end of the speech, first of all, he began to talk about the ways in which whites also have their conversation about race. So he really did not only an unmasking of what the walk is like for Black Americans, but also an unmasking of what the walk is like for white Americans, particularly ethnic whites. And that's who he was speaking to, who say, you know, we have nothing to do with this, and we're suffering as a result of affirmative action, et cetera. So he unmasked that, and then he said, all of this is a distraction. This time, let's talk about the issues. And that's where I think he really switched it up to say, I don't want to just appeal to your emotion. I want to talk about the issues that actually unite us. And I thought that was masterful at the end. Now, will people be willing to buy it? I think it's right for him, and I think it was entirely appropriate for him to say, here's the moment. I'm offering it to you. You know, is America going to accept it or not? But I'm offering you the chance to do this in a way that doesn't go to the stereotypes and the distractions. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see, particularly with the upcoming Pennsylvania primary, you know, whether the message can sink home for all Americans. But I definitely think he spoke to both groups in ways that are quite appealing, but very honest.
Now, I want to ask you guys if you can stay with us. We've got a couple more minutes on the clock now, but can you stay with us after our break?
Of course.
Sure.
Fabulous. So, Ron, this is going to be a short one. Do you think that the issue of issues being put on the table, that, you know, let's talk about the issues now, is that something that people are going to resonate with, or is this conversation going to continue more on symbolism and history?
No, this is going to be on symbolism and history. This race on the Democratic side of the ledger has never been about issues. Senator Obama and Senator Clinton agree so much on health care, education, their views on the war in Iraq, and it's never really been an issue of whether Senator Obama has a different plan or a better plan than Senator Clinton. It's that he has been an element of change and that she has portrayed herself as being the experienced, wise hand at the till. What remains to be seen now moving forward is, will Senator Obama's attempt to shift this to be an issue of issues or a campaign of issues, will he succeed in that, or will this speech today merely reinforce the symbolism between both of those candidates?
This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are continuing a conversation about race and the race, race and the presidential election. Barack Obama came out today to talk about his long-term association with his pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, some conflict over racial issues that some perceive that his loyalties are torn. We've got Sherrilyn Ifill, civil rights lawyer. She teaches at the University of Maryland School of Law in Baltimore. And Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators, former special assistant to President George W. Bush. I'm going to jump right back into this because it strikes me, particularly as we are a day away from the fifth anniversary of the war in Iraq, that loyalty, the concept of loyalty, who you are loyal to as a politician, as a citizen, as a person who believes, is one of the big questions that is raised here. Ron, do voters need to feel that, above all things, that a black man running for president is loyal to America as a whole and not to black America?
I do. I think this is the same thing that Senator Kennedy confronted back in 1960 when people thought that if he were elected president of the United States that he would somehow fall prey to the whims and the wishes of the Vatican rather than swearing to uphold the Constitution of the United States. I think Senator Obama finds himself confronted with an electorate, candidly, that's not quite sure which way his loyalty is. Is he loyal to his church? Is he loyal to his constituency? Or is he loyal to his country? And I think Senator Obama's speech today took a very important step of not only demonstrating that his loyalties are to the United States government, but he spoke so much about our history and so much of our racial identity that we've sought to overcome as a country that I think that he made a very important step in establishing that, yes, he is a member of the African-American community, and that community is important to him, but also equally as important, he is proud to be an American. He said that he loved his country and that he found his salvation in our strength as a nation. So I thought it was a very, very important speech and very important remarks for him to have made today.
I'm going to ask you this, Ron, first, and then Sherrilyn. Does this change any dynamics in the race for the presidency? Do you think that, I mean, it's a crystal ball question, but do you think that in the end this will lift Barack Obama's fortunes or depress them, that even talking about this could be dangerous?
Too soon to be said. I think there was a new Quinnipiac poll that came out today that showed Senator Clinton having a commanding double-digit lead in Pennsylvania. I'd certainly like to see the polling over the next 48 hours. What was the real barometer? What was the real sense across the country of Americans who perhaps tuned in to listen to Senator Obama talk about racial issues for the first time head-on? How did they feel? How did he make them feel? I think it's a little too soon to be said, but I think this is one of the defining moments of his candidacy. If he can put this issue away from him and he can continue his lead with the pledged delegates, he will be the delegate for President of the United States on the Democratic side. If, however, on the other hand, that people are a little turned off by his comments and his views, that will give Senator Clinton another opening and another reason for her to say to the electorate, I'm the one who can beat Senator McCain. So it's going to be very interesting how this plays out.
Sherrilyn?
I think two things. One, I think it can only advantage him to have kind of taken the bull by the horns on this, because the reality is that he is a black candidate, and this was going to happen. That is, the confrontation over, you know, where do your loyalties lie, you know, is he black enough? How black is he? All of that stuff. What's going to happen? Either it was going to happen now while he's trying to get the nomination on the Democratic side, or it was going to happen if he was the nominee in the general election contest. And so I actually think there's tremendous advantage to a black candidate walking towards this issue instead of trying to run away from it. So I think that's an advantage. But I think a lot's going to depend, I hate to say it, on what bites of this the media takes over the next 48 hours. I think most people, working people, will not have heard the whole speech. And unless they go back on C-SPAN or some other network and find the whole speech, they're only going to hear the parts that are offered up by the media. Even at the top of the hour when NPR did the snippet, they did the part about I couldn't reject right any more than I could reject the black community. They didn't include the part about the white grandmother. You included that, Farai, on your show, but it wasn't in the news clip. So it depends, I think. You know, Ron was talking about the next 48 hours. I think he's right, but it all depends on what pieces of this the media decides to put front and center over the next 48 hours. In its entirety, it's masterful, and I think would be tremendously appealing across the board. The problem is most people, many people who are going to be voting, for example, in Pennsylvania, will not have heard the whole speech, will not have been able to take in all of the dimensions, and as I said at the top, the complexity of it, which I think you really need in order to get the full measure of it.
So well, I do want to
depend on media treatment.
What I do want to throw in is that our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, does have the full text of the speech, and so we definitely want to hear from people over the course of the coming days as to what they hear, what they think about it. And I think the blogosphere is one of these places where we're going to see a lot of that opinion bubble up very quickly. Ron, when you think about this moment in American history, everyone, you know, certainly as a political reporter, you want to say, okay, well, what's going to happen in history? And history is not written until the moment happens. But regardless of whether or not Barack Obama wins the nomination for his party or the presidency, will this have fundamentally changed the nature of politics in America?
Absolutely. This is the first time that you have had a legitimate candidate for president of the United States who happens to be African-American, who not only has a shot to win his party's nomination, but to actually be the individual occupying that chair in the Oval Office at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I think Senator Obama's candidacy has forever changed the way that we look at where African-American politicians are able to reach for, to aspire toward, and to run for. He's a senator from a major state. He's a candidate running for president of the United States. Again, as I said from the top, I think that this speech will be analyzed and dissected for generations to come, certainly looking all the way back to Senator Kennedy and his important speech in 1960. Senator Obama as an African-American candidate has forever changed the landscape of politics in the United States.
Well, Ron and Sherrilyn, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
We've been speaking with Ron Christie, the vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators, also with Sherrilyn Ifill, a law professor at the University of Maryland. You can go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, to read Obama's full speech and tell us what you think. This week on Africa Update, Sudan and Chad sign a peace deal, and a U.S. military study finds that many suicide bombers in Iraq come from North Africa. For more, we've got Bill Fletcher. He's a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of TransAfrica Forum. Hi, Bill.
Hey, I'm glad to be back.
So last week, the presidents of Sudan and Chad signed a peace deal in Senegal, the Dakar Agreement. They promised to stop armed groups in the Darfur region from staging attacks along their shared border. So if they're successful, the pact would represent a step towards ending the violence in Darfur. What's the significance of this deal?
I think we should talk about the potential significance of the deal, and that is that there have been these cross-border raids. There have been Chad rebel groups based in the Sudan that have been attempting to overthrow President Deby of Chad. And there have been Sudanese rebel groups based in Chad that have been active in the Darfur region, at least. And so what this may do, if it works, is help to, if not demilitarize the situation, reduce the tension and conflict along the border, and may make it easier to start dealing with the humanitarian crisis that exists among the refugees and displaced people.
Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed and 2.5 million people displaced. What stake, you know, Darfur has come up in the context of the U.S. relationship to China, China's relationship to Sudan. There's a whole cascade of international relations that are being called up as this issue is being debated. But what's the significance for the U.S. from the U.S. perspective of dealing with this region?
this is a highly unstable region. Chad is a de facto neo-colony of France, to be blunt. President Déby was saved essentially by French troops, and so he runs a very unpopular government in Chad, and even though these rebels that attacked are being prompted by the government of General al-Bashir of the Sudan, there are domestic reasons within Chad that the situation would be unstable. Obviously, the Sudan is unstable. And what the United States worries about, and I think exaggerates it, is that they worry about the potential impact of terrorist groups in that region further destabilizing the situation. I would argue you don't need terrorist groups to destabilize the situation because the nature of most of the governments there, the police state character of a number of them, despotisms, mean that the situation will remain unstable until we deal with real democracy and economic development.
How much latitude do international peacekeepers have in enforcing this kind of an agreement?
Well, they will have a certain strategic ability because of where they will be placed along the main road into the capital of Chad. So it is it's less a matter of latitude and more the fact that they're going to be standing in the way of rebels that would be coming out of the Sudan. Again, as we've discussed in other programs, one of the problems that we in the United States have is that when we look at these conflicts, we look primarily at how to stop the fighting, how to get the various sides to put down their guns, as opposed to understanding what are the political dynamics in these countries that have led to the situation in the first place, and the economic dynamics, and what must be done. And that's where the U.S. comes up short almost all the time in really playing a constructive role.
Now, let's move on to another huge topic. A new U.S. military study found that most suicide bombers in Iraq are foreigners. Many of them have come from North African nations like Libya, Sudan, Algeria. Saudi Arabia is still the largest single source, and the report described who the typical suicide bomber was based on interrogations of fighters. It found that a lot of the bombers are alienated young men, students, workers with blue-collar jobs. Now, Bill, back in December, after two car bombs exploded in Algeria, we talked about the rise of militant attacks in North Africa. Is North Africa a hotbed of terrorism, either internally or in terms of exporting fighters?
I wouldn't describe it as a hotbed of terrorism. I'd describe it as a hotbed of discontent, of frustration. And one of the roots of dealing with that frustration happens to be for people to join terrorist groups. But terrorist groups, by and large, and this may sound contrary to the popular wisdom, Farai, terrorist groups, by and large, really are emblematic of weak social movements. And so the question is, why are there weak social movements when there is despair and economic distress in many of these countries? And part of the reason is that many of the governments that are in power, for example, in Egypt, Morocco, or Saudi Arabia for that matter, were put in power either with the direct involvement of the United States or the complicity of the United States, and there were active efforts to suppress indigenous, secular, left and nationalist movements that did not rely on terrorism. So with the elimination of many of these groups, many of the younger, particularly men, but increasingly women, have found terrorism as the route to express their despair, their utter contempt for these police states.
That's a situation or an argument that does not erase the terror of terrorism, the idea that these attacks are hurting not only the communities where these people come from, but the communities that they go to commit their crimes. So what's the solution? What are some of the solutions, either from U.S. policy perspective, a national perspective within these countries? Where do you see the hope coming from?
Well, one of the things which is not something that we do in this country very well is recognize that we have a nickel in this dime. And that there is complicity in creating the situation. So we have to recognize that. The second is that if youth are going to be turned away from terrorism, which they must, then there must be economic development and political development in these countries, which means, for example, that instead of the United States giving unqualified support to President Mubarak in Egypt, Egypt must be encouraged to make a democratic transition, not simply multi-party elections, but where there's a flowering of social movements accompanied by real economic development that's designed by the people of Egypt. The same in Algeria, which went through an extremely bloody civil war. So in no way am I apologizing for the terrorism. I'm saying that the terrorism is an example or an illustration of the deep frustration that exists in many of these countries that does not get channeled in productive directions.
Well, before we let you go, just tell us very briefly about an Afro-Arab youth festival that was held in Uganda. Do you see that as an example of one of these efforts to try to knit people together as opposed to letting them fall into despair?
Oh, absolutely. This is fascinating. And it's fascinating in part because there's almost no coverage in the U.S. media. It's interesting that President Gaddafi of Libya gave the closing address. And one of the things that he pointed out, which we've talked about before, is that this distinction between Arabs and Africans is actually a false distinction. Two-thirds of those people who identify as Arab, as President Gaddafi pointed out, are in Africa. And so there is a question of breaking down the barriers that exist between the self-identified Arab and those that are not. And what President Gaddafi was emphasizing was continental unity. I think that that theme needs to continue to be hammered away. And this conference is hopefully a step in addressing that, as well as addressing real divisions that exist in the continent that are ethnically based or ethnically focused, at least.
Very briefly, do you think that some of the wounds cannot be healed? Ongoing issues of slavery and trafficking. Bringing kids together is great, but it's not enough always, is it?
It's not enough. I'm an optimist. I believe that things can be healed, but what it necessitates is recognition of history as opposed to trying to get beyond it. And the second is actually taking steps to encourage nonviolent debate and exchanges where different sides are getting to know one another and understand that one, in fact, can disagree without being disagreeable or without picking up an AK-47.
Well, Bill, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of TransAfrica Forum, and he spoke with us from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Trey Ellis is known for writing great novels and screenplays. In his new memoir, Bedtime Stories, Adventures in the Land of Single Fatherhood, he covers unimaginable family tragedies and talks about how he found humor in being a single dad. Trey Ellis told me how he approached telling his own story in his own way.
It was interesting because my first novel, Platitudes, was pretty fictional. My second two novels, Right Here, Right Now, and Home Repairs, especially Home Repairs, was pretty autobiographical. So this time, I really wanted to try my hand at writing a novel about myself. So I tried to write it as artfully as you would write a novel, with the same kind of conceits that I put into, let's say, Platitudes, my kind of funny screenplays and music lyrics and footnotes, and write it artistically, but tell the story of my life. And that was the tricky part, to see myself as a character, and not as myself.
You have, at one point in the book, you talk about all these dreams that you had to write books and to direct, and you write, "I'm convinced that my delusion of seeing the story of my life is just that, a grand story, is the only thing that has staved off even more debilitating mental illnesses." What does that mean?
Well, you know, I've been through a lot. You know, with my wife leaving, but before that with the suicide of my mother and my dad dying of AIDS complications. So all these things hitting me, and that was, both those happened when I was, you know, before I was 22. The way I coped with these disasters was seeing myself as the hero of my own story and thinking, oh, okay, in this story, the guy survives. He doesn't kill himself. He doesn't commit himself to a mental hospital. He actually survives and thrives and overcomes these obstacles.
And in addition to that, you've also had kidney problems, and you talk really frankly about just how much strength it took you to do really basic things because you were constantly dealing with your body rebelling against you.
Yeah, I'm going through that right now. I'm on the top of the list for a transplant now, and I don't really want a transplant right now because I'm doing all right. So at this point, I kind of bring it on. I just, you know, I can take it.
What about the good stuff? There are many good things in your life, and two of them are Ava and Chet, your kids. What are they like?
They are the best kids in the world. You know, I'm really lazy, so I get up at 7, wake them up, and then go back to sleep for a half hour before I have to rush them to school. And Chet snuck into my bed and just said, I'm you know, just daddy hug me, you know, at 6 still. And so I spent a half hour just hugging him. So the rest of my day was great because of that. And Ava thinks that I'm, you know, like the Beatles rolled into one. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think has changed for them as kids from having a single father as opposed to a single mother or as opposed to a couple? How do you think it might have changed their lives?
Yeah, that's a hard thing to figure out because, you know, when my ex-wife moved out, Chet was only about 8 months old, and she moved down the street. So she still was in their life, but I've always been, you know, the primary person for both of them. So it's really the only thing they know. So it's hard to tell. You know, they've got friends who are divorced. They've got friends that are raised by single mothers, friends whose parents get along well, friends whose parents don't get along well. They still, obviously, you know, Chet said, if I had one wish, Daddy, it would be that you two would get undivorced. But he doesn't even know what it's like to have us together in the same place. To compensate for that, I just try to spoil them with as much love as I can.
You also talk a lot about your own dating and the good, the bad, and the ugly. Bedtime Stories has a subtitle, Adventures in the Land of Single Fatherhood. So are the adventures that you take in dating as a single father profoundly different than the ones that you had before you were married?
Yeah, I mean, they're profoundly different for me, especially because I was pretty nerdy and didn't have a lot of dates before I was married, and I was really lucky to get married. Now I'm more self-assured, but the thing now, which is funny, is that my kids sort of act the way parents, I think, act for most people, you know, when they're teenagers, that I sneak around dating under the noses of my kids. So when they're asleep in the other room, I can have a date and close the door and you know, not have them know about it.
Have you ever been busted?
No. That's why I have locks on the doors. I'm very good about that. There was one time when we were, you know, when I had, I was engaged after the divorce. And I remember one night, the next morning, my son said something like, you know, were you hurt last night? Something about the noises he heard the night before. And that was horrifying.
Yeah, you're like, Daddy stubbed his toe. go
lot.
Back to sleep. Would you ever consider, it sounds like you have in the past, but at this point, are you looking to find love? And at what, how would that have to fit into you already having a family?
Yeah, I think about that a lot. And that's really the lesson for me from this book is that I'm still an incurable romantic, but I'm now an incurable romantic about my kids. A lot of the pressure that was on my relationships before has been relieved now because I know that I'm not going to grow old alone. As long as I can keep my kids loving me, I've got that part taken care of. So that's freed me to really take more time when I meet somebody to make sure that it's right and make sure that it's right in all kind of ways, firing on all cylinders, not just the person's beautiful or that they take care of my kids or anything, that it's got to fit. I can be very, very picky now, thanks to my love for my kids.
So it sounds like everything is, if not all written and done, at least you have a sense of hope. Is that too corny a word to use for this? It sounds like with everything you've been through over the years that you're still a romantic about life.
Yeah, that's what's, you know, a little crazy about me because and that's what my friends point out often. And even in the middle of terrible things happening to me, if there's one little piece of something positive happening, I'll think yes. And I make these crazy logical leaps, like if some little positive thing happens, I suddenly think that that, you know, Tom Cruise is going to star in some movie and is going to give me a bucket loads of money and everything's fine. And they're delusions, but they keep me warm at night.
So this book just screams out to be made into a movie. It's written, no doubt, because of your skills in a very cinematic style. If it gets made into a movie, who do you want to play you?
There are a couple of people. I mean, I would think Terrence Howard would be terrific because he's so handsome, and I'd feel like, wow, that's such an idealized version of myself. And I love Don Cheadle as well. He's so brilliant, and I'd be honored if either one of them would play me.
Sounds good. Trey, thanks so much. Enjoyed the
book.
Thank
you.
Novelist, screenwriter, and blogger Trey Ellis, his new memoir is Bedtime Stories, Adventures in the Land of Single Fatherhood. You can read an excerpt on our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. Tomorrow marks the fifth-year anniversary for the Iraq War. News headlines usually highlight what soldiers face during their time in Iraq. But what happens when those soldiers come home? How do they settle into life stateside, and are there things that a soldier could actually miss about Iraq? Here to tell us about life after living in the battle zone is Army Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Jones. He's a career military man who's done two tours in the current conflict in Iraq. He worked as a convoy commander near the Iraqi city of Tikrit, and his service earned him a Purple Heart. Jeremiah, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So how'd you first get into the military?
After I graduated from high school in 1987, I tried, different odd and end jobs. I really didn't do too good, as far as going to college or furthering my education. So I figured the military would be the best thing for me to get out and see the world and further experience life.
Is your family have any experience being in the military?
Well, my grandfather was a Korean era veteran. My dad was a Vietnam War era veteran. I got an uncle that was in the Air Force, an aunt that was in the Air Force. And I think that's about it. And then me.
So you went in having some family tales told around the dinner table, no doubt, about what it meant to serve. But were you prepared to go into war yourself?
Well, I joined in 1989, and less than a year after I joined, I went to Desert Storm. So tell you the truth, by the time Desert Storm started and the time it ended, I was so young at the time that I really didn't understand, or really didn't take in effect, the full gravity of what war is until now. Now I could say I wasn't really prepared for what I was going to see.
Some people have said that this war is fundamentally different than Desert Storm because this is a war where you are occupying territory as opposed to just taking it. And do you think it's a more difficult war, the current Iraq war?
Well, of course it's different because I've been in both and I can compare the two from experience. Back in Desert Storm, I believe we lost 1,500 soldiers, and maybe more than 50% of them were either accidental deaths or something like that, other than enemy fire. Now, coming up on Thursday, the number is going up to 4,000, and that's all combat-related and enemy, death by enemy fire. Plus, like you said, we're occupying. In Desert Storm, it was easy. We just stormed through, kicked them out of the country, and then we left. Now, I don't know what we're trying to do now other than, changing them to a democracy or, changing their way of life and freeing the citizens there and showing them a different way of life or a better way of life. So, yeah, it's a lot harder.
What were you told? I mean, how much are you told about what the ultimate mission is? Was there a lot of messaging around what the bigger goals were or just your job is to do this on this day and get this done so we can keep on keeping on?
Exactly. That's exactly what I got was, this is your job. You're a convoy commander. Your job is to move this equipment, these trucks, this personnel from point A to point B safely. We'll let you know when you come back and do the same thing on the way back. And that's it.
As a convoy commander, you're on the roads, which can be extremely dangerous in this situation. What were some of the scarier moments, or even if you weren't scared, what would be scary to us? What were some of the moments where you felt that your life was in danger?
The scariest part is before a mission, right before you leave the gate, because you're just the fear of the unknown. You don't know what's going to be in store for you out there on the road. And when you first reach your destination and you look back at whatever you went through, you know, either firefights, IEDs, RPGs or anything like that, you look back and like, oh my God, you know, I just made it through all that. You know, but during the mission, you're not really scared at all. Your instincts just kick in, and from your training, you just do your job.
You actually survived a hit that earned you a Purple Heart. Tell us what happened there.
Well, it wasn't just one hit. I've got hit 13 times total. The first one was the very bad one, and the last one that you're talking about where I got my Purple Heart, I was the convoy commander of that mission, and we were going to block traffic, and I'd seen a pickup truck on the left-hand side in this intersection that really didn't look quite right, so I told my gunners to take a look at him, and as soon as we got a fix on him, he took off. We turned to make chase, and he was blocking the way for three landmines, and as soon as we turned the corner to follow him, we ran over that and blew my truck in half. My gunner, he broke a couple of his ribs. My driver got his foot broke, and me, I got stitches and a little limp and a little loss of feeling in my right arm, but other than that, that's in a nutshell what happened.
Have you lost any friends in the war?
Yes, ma'am. I lost a good friend of mine, and I was a squad leader, Matthew Soper. He got killed on the convoy after mine when I got the Purple Heart. It was a continuation of mine the very next day. So, yeah, and it's kind of hard. I met his family, you know, and they take it a lot harder. I think his friends, the guys that were there, we took it a lot harder than anybody else. But, yeah, I have.
What about life in the United States after you've been in a war zone? When you come back and you put your foot on American soil, I'm sure that there are a lot of emotions. What are some of the different things that happen to you as you ease back into civilian life?
Yeah, I don't think there's an ease into it. You say put my foot on American soil. As soon as I stepped off that plane in Indianapolis, I fell face forward onto the tarmac and started hugging the ground because I was so happy to be home. I guess the hardest part, especially being a convoy commander on the road, is dealing with traffic out on the expressways. It's kind of scary there because you're constantly scanning the roads and, you know, you see people up behind you tailgating you. And me, I get upset because, you know, I'm doing it now. When you talk about it, it flashes through your mind. You want to push people out of the way because in Iraq, we had total control of the road. We own the road. And if you got in our way, we'd push you off to the side. But here at home, you can't do that. I'd be classified as road rage. And I have to watch my attitude when I'm driving still.
What does your family think of you? I mean, do they think of you? I'm sure they think of you with great pride, but do they ever say, okay, Jeremiah, let's talk for a second. This is crazy dangerous. You don't have to keep doing this. You could do something else.
Yeah, a lot of them do, but, you know, my wife, she's like, you know, don't you volunteer to go back. I think as long as I don't volunteer to go over, you know, I'll be fine. You know, but my family, they know me. You know, that's just my life. You know, when I get out of high school and join the military, I found my niche in life, and the military is what it is, and I love my job. So they're not going to try to take that away from me because there's really nothing else I want to do.
Do you ever miss the adrenaline of being in a war zone or a war time?
Oh, yeah, I love it. I'm sorry, but it's not that I'm a warmonger, but there is a certain high you get that you'll never get over here. You know, that's why I guess people go bungee jumping or, you know, skydiving or some of that craziness. But there is a certain amount of adrenaline rush that you get. Even when I get hit all those times, you know, there's a feeling that you get and you're shaking and you get kind of, you know, you get kind of used to it. So I do miss it, but, you know, I don't miss it enough to go back anytime soon. I'm not going to volunteer.
When you think about the losses, people who have been killed and some of the ones who've been profoundly injured in ways where they'll never lead an independent life again, do you ever ask yourself the question, is it worth it? Is that a question you ask yourself?
No, I can't never ask that question. If I do, then I'll start doubting my orders and doubting my job. But I will tell you this, up to the point to where we caught Saddam Hussein, you know, one life is too many to lose, but it was worth the lives up until that point. So from that point on to down, as long as we catch bin Laden, we free people, and we do our jobs, it'll be worth it. I'm not saying that we should have any American young men and women killed, but as long as we get the job done, then that's the sacrifice we have to make, even if it takes my own.
Well, Jeremiah, thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for having me.
That's Army Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Jones. He served two tours in Iraq as a convoy commander. He currently lives in Cassopolis, Michigan.